Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
Support for The Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Democratic presidential candidate Michael Bennet has gone all in for New Hampshire. Although he has staff in Iowa, Bennet says the Granite State is where he's really hoping for a strong finish, despite his low poll numbers right now. So toward that end, the Colorado senator recently kicked off a series of 50 town hall meetings in the 10 weeks before primary day. This hour in The Exchange, we talk with Senator Bennet about his policy ideas and where he fits in the Democratic field. Later on, a New Hampshire-based Middle East expert gives her views on Iran, Iraq, and U.S. foreign policy. As always, we welcome your questions. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. And Senator Bennet, welcome. Really nice to meet you.
It's very nice to meet you, Laura.
So you joined this race after dealing with prostate cancer. You received a clean bill of health last April, decided to run for president after that. Once it was over, congratulations on
that,
by the way. Let's just put that right out there. So what makes you a better choice, Senator Bennet, than the other Democrats who are running?
I think I'm a better choice because I've got a different range of experience. I was in business and I was the superintendent of one of the largest school districts in America. And then I spent 10 years in the Senate, engaged in a lot of bipartisan work, but there long enough to understand the nature of the corruption there and why the most important things don't actually get done. And I don't believe the other candidates have diagnosed it the same way I have, and I think they'd have a hard time overcoming it if they became president.
A lot of candidates are talking about corruption. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, so how are you different?
I think I'm different because I understand how to build a coalition of Americans to create a constituency for change to overcome that corruption. I think Bernie and Elizabeth both believe that the answer here is to substitute our more preferred version of single-party rule for their version of single-party rule. And I just disagree with that. I think we're not going to make any progress by doing that. I don't want to spend the next 10 years fighting a losing battle for Medicare for All when I think that we could end childhood poverty in the 8 years that I was president and give the middle class in this country a huge boost. I'd rather work on those issues.
So let's focus on what's doable instead of fighting over what's not doable?
It's not even what's doable. It's what is. It is the way you build a political movement in this country to overcome the entrenched forces in Washington, D.C. That requires winning purple states. And it's one thing to run and win a Senate race in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and I have deep respect, obviously, for the people that live there. But I'm the only candidate in this race who's won two national elections in a swing state. It's the swing state of Colorado. And it requires something different. And I think for the Democratic Party to not just beat Donald Trump, but also win the Senate again, and then on the back end of that, be able to govern the country again, we need to reinvent our politics. And
why do you think that message isn't resonating, Senator Bennet? You don't need me to tell you, you're way down in the polls.
I got in the race later. I'm much less well known than either Bernie or Elizabeth or many of the candidates in the race. And so I've been playing catch up the whole time. And that actually is why I've embarked on the strategy to have 50 additional town halls. I've already spent more time in New Hampshire than any other.
Yeah, you've been here a lot.
I've had, I had 33 town halls before I said I'd do 50. Hilariously, I saw a guy downstairs as I was getting on the elevator to come up here today who said, "I remember you came into a fundraiser for John McCain when I was in Denver once." And I said, I said, "I did." He said, "I never saw a Democrat do that before." And he said, "Well, keep it up, because John would have done it this way." And I said, "Well, the only problem is I'm not John McCain, but I do think it's the right strategy."
So it sounds like you are hoping that you'll come across as a A moderate, a pragmatist, a guy who can win in swing states, therefore across the country.
I think I once heard myself described as a pragmatic idealist, and I'll take that. I'm pragmatic because I think we need to get stuff done, and idealist because I believe in democracy. I believe it's essential to humanity that our democracy survive, and that's the way that I've approached the work in the Senate as a school superintendent and as a candidate for president.
So we'll definitely talk about some of the issues in just a moment, Senator Bennett. But so far, the more progressive or liberal wing, call it what you want, seems to be gravitating towards Senator Sanders and Senator Warren. And the more moderate wing seems to be gravitating towards Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg. So how are you going to sort of get a wedge in there into that?
I think it's by having 50 more town halls in New Hampshire. New Hampshire has made the difference before. And I think, you know, my experience is very different from Mayor Pete's. My school district's budget was 3 times the size of South Bend, Indiana's budget, just for perspective. And I'm of a different generation than he is. And with respect to Vice President Biden, I respect his service. But when he says that if we just get rid of Donald Trump, it will somehow all go back to normal, it ignores the very profound structural issues that exist in our democracy that have been created by the Supreme Court and Citizens United, the partisan gerrymandering that's happened, the money that has supported the Freedom Caucus's disabling of our exercise in self-government. All of that has to be overcome. And it can't be overcome with bumper stickers. It can't be overcome with slogans. It has to be overcome by very tough political work, organizing state after state after state of people to fix it.
In a moment, I want to ask you about immigration and education. Big issues for you, Senator Bennett. I want to invite our listeners, though, to join us as well. Our number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And for the first half of our show today, we're talking with Colorado Democratic Senator Michael Bennett. He's running for president, really banking on New Hampshire for his success. We'd love your questions and comments. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Senator Bennett, you've not been on the debate stage for some time, falling short of polling and fundraising thresholds set up by the party. And you said in New Hampshire recently, quote, "The debates I don't think have done very much for the Democratic Party. I think they sort of played into Donald Trump's hands. I can see why it's entertaining and part of what we should do, but it shouldn't be the central way we conduct this election." Still, not everybody can go to your town halls. Many candidates don't go up to Berlin or Milan or more rural parts of the state. So the debates do give voters a chance to see contenders. So what would you change?
Well, I do go to those rural parts of the state, by the way, and I think it's important for people to do that. I think it'd be much more useful for us to have a longer form town hall format that would allow candidates either alone or together to appear and answer the audience's questions in an in-depth way. The thing about the debates is, you know, I suppose it's important to know whether the president can answer a question in 30 seconds or prepare a soundbite for just the right moment in a debate. But I doubt very much that's the most important credential for a president, especially when the president is Donald Trump. So I will say that I think the DNC made a terrible mistake by throwing a bunch of us off the debate stage. New Hampshire is less decided today than New Hampshire was 6 weeks ago or 6 months ago or a year ago, because what people are trying to figure out is which of these, I call them mugs, usually I'm referring to myself, but which of these people can actually take on Donald Trump and beat him, which is the right question for people to be asking. And I think it's not resolved in the voters' minds in New Hampshire, which is why it seems crazy to me that we would have limited the number of people that would have had that kind of exposure on the debates. It may sound self-serving of me to say it, but I think history will show that I was right.
Let's talk about a central part of your campaign, Senator Bennett. You call it the real deal. You say it would cost $6 trillion. There's a lot in here to unpack, but there's one piece that I would really like to ask you about. A big part of this plan is what some people describe as universal basic income for kids. Now, Andrew Yang has been talking about universal basic income for everybody. How would your approach work?
The way this would work would be we would increase the child tax credit from $2,000 today to $3,600 for every kid under the age of six, more than $3,000 for every kid over the age of six. It would be available to everybody, up to people making $180,000. So actually, this is a massive tax cut for the middle class. Columbia University has looked at the proposal and said it would cut childhood poverty in America by 40% in 1 year. It would end $2 a day poverty for kids in America. Those are kids who are living in families that are literally living on $2 a day. From an education point of view, it would transform the lives of millions of Americans. And from the perspective of giving kids a chance to become participants in our economy and in this democracy, I think it's more important than anything that any other candidate has proposed. So we could accomplish that, by the way, without adding a single federal bureaucrat. So
because it's already in place, you're just expanding.
Exactly. So for
the tax credit,
3% of what Bernie's Medicare for All would cost, we could cut childhood poverty by 40% and give the middle class in America a massive tax cut.
So this would be available to families with kids up to making up to $180,000.
Right.
So it's not for upper middle class or wealthy people.
No.
How do you feel about the argument that $180,000, that's pretty high still. So maybe those folks don't need
a
giant tax credit?
I actually think my proposals, every single one of them at the Real Deal, are tailored to be progressive. Bernie's proposals are not. So his proposal for free college is a regressive proposal. My proposal for free preschool is a progressive proposal. The American Family Act, which is the child tax credit, combined with the expansion of the earned income tax credit, combined with paid family leave, combined with raising the minimum wage in this country, those things taken together, which I have proposed, would give the middle class in America an enormous shot in the arm and give the kids that I used to work for as superintendent in the Denver Public Schools a fighting chance to be a participant in the democracy. I think that's what we should be standing for as the Democratic Party. And as Americans, that is what we should be doing to make sure we leave more opportunity, not less, to the people coming after us.
Let's talk more about education since you mentioned it. And you were the superintendent of schools for Denver, a big district where you shook things up. Senator Bennett, closing so-called underperforming schools, allowing charter schools to operate in district buildings. You don't need me to tell you this upset a lot of people. How does that experience shape your current approach towards education policy?
Well, it certainly
policy?
Didn't upset as many people who were upset by the fact that there were kids in huge swaths of our community who had no decent school to go to, you know, who literally, no matter where they traveled, could not go to a school that would provide them a chance at the American dream. And I think that's what we should be focused on as Americans. Stanford University just did a study of the Denver public schools, and they concluded that the kids in Denver are growing so much faster academically than the kids in the rest of the state of Colorado. It's as if the kids in Denver have 60 additional school days a year compared to their peers. That is incredible. The kids in Denver were dead last in terms of achievement growth 15 years ago. We became one of the fastest growing school districts in America because people who had been fleeing our district at the middle school level and the high school level came back. And so you're right. We did replicate high performing charter schools. We closed low performing charter schools. And overall, there are more kids in non-charter schools today in Denver than there are in charter schools because of the work that we did. In other words, all of it is incremental, right? So we need to make progress as a country here because, unfortunately, our education system today is reinforcing the income inequality we have because the best predictor of the quality of a kid's education is their parents' income. That is ruthless and that is wrong, and we need to change it.
So New Hampshire Democrats recently rejected, again, for the second time, a large federal grant aimed at opening up more charter schools here in New Hampshire. In general, Democrats here say, let's spend the money on improving the regular traditional public schools. And I just wonder how you feel about that,
especially given your experience. I would have voted to reject it, too. Let me tell you why. And first of all, we need to invest more in our public schools. New Hampshire is not investing in its public schools the way it should. Colorado is not investing in our public schools the way we should. And we're not paying our teachers like the professionals that they are. And it's a disgrace. That money was a political ploy by Betsy DeVos, who, you know, I think has been the worst education secretary we ever had. She doesn't believe in accountability for charter schools. And without any accountability, charter schools are a disaster. In the Denver public schools, The charter schools were accountable to exactly the same school performance framework every other school was accountable to.
Because they were public charter schools?
Because they were public charter schools, but because the chartering authority was the school district. You couldn't just, you know, some university couldn't just decide we're going to put a charter school there. Some for-profit couldn't decide we're going to put a charter school there. My school board governed this question, and they were the ones who decided which school was replicated, which school was not. And not only were they under the same accountability system, and DeVos, by the way, doesn't believe in any accountability for schools at all, they had to take the same number of special needs kids and English language learners and kids living in poverty. So how you do this really matters. I think we need to move beyond these political slogans because, frankly, all I care about is that poor kids in America have access to quality education. And I can tell you today, they do not. In broad swaths of American cities and rural areas, there are geographic areas that cover cover a geography that kids could travel all day and not find a school that would give them a chance at becoming a part of our democracy and part of our economy. So I know why they rejected the money, and I think they did it for the right reasons. I agree they should have rejected it.
I want to ask you about immigration, Senator Bennett. You've been working on this issue for a long time. Just to let listeners know, back in 2013, you were one of a bipartisan group of U.S. senators known as the Gang of Eight who came forward with an immigration reform proposal. Passed the Senate, died in the then Republican-controlled House. What did you learn from this, Senator Bennett?
This is a perfect example of why we have to fix the politics in Washington. What I learned from this is an undemocratic group of tyrants called the Freedom Caucus made it impossible for our democracy to work its will.
It's a group of conservatives in the U.S.
Yeah,
House at
well,
that
they
time.
Call themselves conservatives. I think they're radicals, and they don't believe that. They believe that it's their way or the highway on every issue, including immigration. And so if that bill had been allowed to go to the House floor and get a vote from the House of Representatives, it would have passed. And if it had passed, we would have had a pathway to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented people. We would have passed the most progressive Dream Act that had ever been passed. And we would have passed a bill that had $46 billion of border security in it. Not $6 billion for Donald Trump's medieval wall, but actual 21st century border security that would have allowed us to see every inch of the border and do the internal security that's required as well. Instead, the Freedom Caucus prevented it from going forward. And this is just one example of the way they have immobilized our exercise in self-government. And they were a reaction to Barack Obama's election. And for the last 6 years Barack Obama was president, we couldn't get anything through the Congress because of them. We can't even pass a basic infrastructure bill in Washington while China is building 3,500 miles of fiber optic cable to connect Latin America with Africa to export the surveillance state that China is building. And we, as Americans, we have to overcome these people if we're going to turn a democracy over to the next generation that we can be proud of. And that is, to go back to the very first question you asked, I think that is what distinguishes me from the other people in this race. When Joe Biden says if we get rid of Trump, it's just going to go back to normal. If normal is living under the thumb of this radical wing of tyrants called the Freedom Caucus, that's not a normal I want to accept.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, I think Senator Biden has a little bit of a broader message than that. I mean, you sort of characterize his message as if we get rid of Donald Trump, everything will go back to normal.
Well, on this subject, that's
what he's talking a little more broadly than that.
Well, on this subject, I think that's what he said. I want to be fair to him. I mean, what do you...
So, anyway, let's talk more about your policies.
Okay.
I did want to ask you about one more question about the border in terms of illegal crossings. You did seem last year, Senator Bennett, to part ways with your fellow candidates. Last year at a Democratic presidential debate, they did one of those hand-raising things, you know, do you support or do you not support? You were the only candidate who didn't raise his or her hand with the question, do you think illegal border crossings should be treated civilly? So indicating that you feel like illegal border crossings should be treated criminally, can you help me out with that? Help me figure out.
Yeah, I mean,
how do you feel about that?
The after that debate, the President Obama's Secretary of Homeland Security wrote an op-ed piece saying the worst thing you could do for people in Central America would be to decriminalize crossings at the border because it would make the border, the southern border of the United States, a magnet to people who need to have opportunity but have no means of getting it. And I don't think that, you know, that that decriminalizing the border, however one wants to call it, is the answer to solving the issues that people are facing in Central America. I think what we have to do is deal with the refugee crisis that is at our border in a humane way. My mom was a Polish Jew who survived the Holocaust and was separated from her parents at the border. So this isn't political for me.
How would you resolve, or at least help to resolve, clearly the U.S. can't do everything, the refugee crisis that you mentioned at the border? I'm sure you know, we hear many people are fleeing violence in their villages, drug gang violence. They feel like this is their only solution. So how would your plan have approached
that? In 2014, I went down to the border, or not to the border, to El Salvador and to Honduras. So as a parent, I could understand why parents would be putting their kids in the hands of drug smugglers, paying them years' salary to bring them to the border of the United States, knowing they might very well be raped on the way or murdered on the way. And the answer is complete desperation. These are not people looking for jobs. These are people who are fleeing for their lives. I think we need a president who can lead the entire hemisphere to resettle the refugees that are at our border. We should take refugees in the United States. And there are plenty of places that that people would like to go. You know, people at the border don't necessarily want to come here. They might prefer being in a place where people speak Spanish and the cost of living is lower. But Donald Trump is such a failure as a president. He's treated us as a weak and pathetic country that can't resolve issues like this. If I were president, we'd resolve this issue. But not only that, we would work with the Northern Triangle countries of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador to help restore the rule of law and some economic growth so that people actually have some hope and can overcome the gangs that you mentioned that are tormenting them and making their lives a misery.
Let's take some calls again. Great. I want listeners to join us with their questions. In the next 10 minutes or so, we're sitting down with Colorado Democratic Senator Michael Bennett. He's running for president, doing a lot of work toward that end here in New Hampshire. You can join us with an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or phone call 1-800-892-6477. And Ernest is calling from Franconia. Go ahead, Ernest. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask your guest if he could speak a little bit about how he would manage the cost of his proposed child tax credit cut for the middle class. As we've seen very often in the last few years, tax cuts tend to raise deficits an awful lot. We have entitlement programs and an aging population. So how would we balance the cost of this next tax cut?
Ernest, I really appreciate the point, and I have been asking some candidates, Senator Bennett. We now hear that our federal deficit is approaching $1 trillion. I remember when debt was measured in trillions,
right,
and deficits,
right,
didn't even come close,
right,
to that. So it is yeah, something that needs to be addressed.
Yeah. Well, first of all, to Ernest's point, for background, over the 10 years that I've been in Washington, it's been very unclear to me that Democrats in general care about this issue. And Republicans say they care about it, but they are lying because the hypocrisy is just staggering. I mean, we are going to have a $1 trillion deficit going to $2 trillion at full employment because of the irresponsibility that's going on down there. Every single dollar of the $6 trillion that I have proposed in this campaign that's incremental, I have offset either with savings or with taxes, because I certainly don't want to make matters worse. The $22 trillion of debt that we have on the balance sheet is a theft from the next generation of Americans. There is nothing progressive about it. Sometimes I hear progressives say the debt doesn't matter. That is ridiculous. We are constraining the choices our kids will make, and we're failing to invest in them. We've cut our investment in them by 35% while we're stacking this debt on top of them. That is a moral theft from them, and it's deeply unfair. So we have to solve it. And in the proposals that I've made in this election, every single one of them is paid for, including $2 trillion of the $6 trillion that's paid for with what I call a smart wealth tax. Compare that to what Elizabeth Warren has proposed. She's proposed $41 trillion of incremental spending and has shown how she'll pay for almost none of that. Bernie Sanders has proposed $55 trillion of incremental spending and has proposed how he's going to pay for none of it. In fact, he wears it as a badge of courage that he's not going to pay for any of it. $55 trillion is far more than we're going to spend over the next 10 years as a federal government. $41 trillion is about the same amount. So, you know, I don't think we're going to beat Donald Trump with a bunch of empty promises. And I don't think we're going to beat Donald Trump not paying for the stuff we're proposing. The fact that he has been as fiscally irresponsible as he has been is something that we should be running on and pointing out, because it is a disgrace.
So, Senator Bennett, people like Ernest are concerned about the deficit. We've heard this from other people. And I hear you critiquing the big spending proposals of some of your rivals. And yet those two people, especially that you just mentioned, Sanders and Warren, they're like number one and number two and number three in most polls. So I just wonder what that says to you about the Democratic Party.
Let me say it again. Maybe it's possible to win a Democratic primary promising a whole bunch of people free stuff. I do not think it's possible to beat Donald Trump doing that. And I'm in this race to beat Donald Trump and change the way Washington works. Do you know, since 2001, we have borrowed $5 trillion from the Chinese to give the richest people in America tax cuts. We have borrowed $5.6 trillion from the Chinese to fight two wars in the Middle East that lasted 20 years and did not result in outcomes that the American people should feel very satisfied with. So the impatience you hear in my voice is that the cost of losing to Donald Trump for the children that I used to work for in the Denver Public Schools and kids just like them all over America is existential. And that's why we have to win. And that's why we have to run on a set of proposals like the child tax credit that is a massive tax cut for the middle class and lifts kids out of poverty that would be wildly popular all over America and build political momentum for a progressive agenda. That, at least, is my theory of the case.
Senator Bennett, you mentioned foreign policy and Middle East wars, and I did want to briefly ask you about what we've been seeing in Iran. You're on the Senate Intelligence Committee, so clearly you are keyed into this. What would your strategy be in this region, especially given Iran's interest in becoming, you know, a major player? I mean, we've seen a lot of back and forth between Iran and the U.S. Now, you've said President Trump's strategy, not good. You'd like to see a larger strategy. That's fine. We understand, because you're running against to defeat President Trump. But what would your approach be?
Yeah, and let me not just lay it on Donald Trump. I mean, our own War College did a 2,000-page assessment of the Iraq War, which I just mentioned, and their conclusion was Iran won our Iraq War. And the reason why they concluded that is that since the time we invaded Iraq and toppled Saddam Hussein, Iran has been able to spread its malevolent behavior throughout the Middle East, from Yemen into Iraq, into Syria, into Lebanon. And that is a huge danger for us and for Israel. So I think the key for us, if I were president, would be to mobilize our allies around the world to make sure we were pushing back on what Iran is doing, both conventionally and with its nuclear weapons. It cannot be a go-it-alone strategy. That is an invitation for another 25-year war in the Middle East. The Obama administration's very good work, not perfect work, but very good work on the Iran deal, was a really good example.
So you would have stayed in that if you were president.
Yes, as an attempt to actually manage a problem in the Middle East rather than go to war with it for once. And so more of that and less of Trump playing into the hands of the hardliners in Iran, I think, would be good for America.
Another concern now is that Iran will conduct cyber attacks on America. They've done this before, including in your home state of Colorado, where Iranian cyber criminals attacked the Department of Transportation, I believe. Just real quickly, because you are on the Intelligence Committee, how well prepared are we for this possibility?
I can't speak to any actual intelligence, but I can answer your question.
Of course.
We are not prepared well enough. Fortunately, because of the men and women who are working diligently in our intelligence agencies, we are better protected today than we were when Russia attacked us in 2016, even though Donald Trump won't even admit that the Russians attacked our democracy or continuing to attack our democracy. We need to get much better prepared for the kind of cyber attacks that we're going to face, not just from Russia, but, as you mentioned, from Iran, from China as well, and North Korea.
Senator Bennett, last question, a more personal question. You've been called one of the most literary contenders for president. Your mom was a librarian. Full disclosure, your dad, Doug Bennett, used to run NPR back in the day. Your brother is editorial page editor of the New York Times, so lots of emphasis on the written word in your family. And I've heard that you often start meetings by asking what people are reading. I'm going to turn the tables. What are you reading right now, Senator Bennett? If you have time to read, your campaign
I do. I actually, one thing I'm reading right now, which I've never read before, is Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail.
That's a classic.
You know, another classic is, you know, I've been reading some Seneca because it's the only way to sort of maintain your equilibrium when you've got Donald Trump as your president. But two books I would recommend. I wouldn't recommend those. I'd recommend these two books. Casey Gerald's There Will Be No Miracles Here, which is an incredible memoir by a 32-year-old American citizen that everybody should read, and Evicted by Matthew Desmond, which is about the housing crisis that so many families in America are facing because of our counterproductive federal housing laws.
Okay, and we have our candidate tracker on NHPR.org, but where are you heading next today, Senator?
I'm actually getting on an airplane. Having been in New Hampshire all weekend, I'm going back to Washington for the impeachment, which we didn't even talk about.
Sure.
But I'll see you at one of the town halls over the next 30 days or so.
Well,
thank you, New Hampshire.
It was nice to meet you. Thank you very much for being here.
Laura. Thanks for having me.
That's Colorado U.S. Senator Michael Bennett, a Democratic presidential candidate. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.